We begin with a story from opednews.com. Torture. Okay, Pelosi knew it in 2002, but what could all this really mean? The article is by Michael Shaw. The CIA memo stating Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid were briefed by the Bush administration about enhanced interrogation techniques that were being administered on a terrorist suspect says it all to many. But does it really say it all? Think about it. Yes, it does prove Pelosi is a liar over saying she was not briefed on torture methods being implemented. I won't argue that point. But it also leaves us with a whole lot of other stuff to think about. For example, this so-called Gang of Four, who were briefed and then gagged, they were issued a gag order, could very well have been a well-played and orchestrated plot by the neocons to ensure there'd be no investigations or prosecutions into their many wrongdoings. It could have been a sort of Damocles hanging over the heads for the purpose of political blackmail, their ace in the hole. For example, what was the real reason Pelosi took impeachment off the table as her first action as Speaker? Could it also be the reason why Bush and the telecons were taken off the hook for illegally domestic spying and direct violation of FISA laws? Or why there were no federal prosecutions or major steps taken for the outing of Valerie Plame? Why no action was taken concerning doctored intelligence to involve us in an illegal preemptive war in Iraq? The list goes on and on. In fact, after taking a good hard look, it might explain every goofy action or inaction by the Democrats in 6 of the 8 long years Bush was president. Don't forget, in 2002, the entire nation was behind Bush in the war. To say anything negative about Bush and his administration was construed as unpatriotic and to some even treasonous. So even if Pelosi and Reid had openly condemned these acts and torture, at the very least, they would have been labeled as unpatriotic. And if they told anyone else outside of that briefing, under the guidelines of national security, they, in fact, could have been arrested and prosecuted by the Bush administration as traitors. Even though speaking out, in spite of potential prosecution upon themselves, would have been the right thing to do, it's easy to see why under these precise guidelines as to why they didn't speak out. We also note that John McCain had been briefed. He also said nothing either, but it could, in fact, explain why he flip-flopped on torture to Bush right after he came out and spoke against it. He subsequently watered down his own anti-torture legislation to render it nothing more than a worthless rag. If you want even more irony, right now the neocon right are using the CIA memo to crucify Pelosi. What the sheep of the GOP apparently do not get is that this memo also dispels the Republican-generated myth that the full Congress and Senate knew and approved of these torture techniques, created and deployed by their beloved President George W. Bush. As for Pelosi and Reid, now's the time to speak up. It is also time for the Democrats to cut the crap, cut their losses, and proceed with a complete, impartial investigation followed by the necessary prosecutions. It's either that or go down in infamy with the entire Bush entourage. My commentary for today, May 13th. An example of how TV is changing our reality. I was watching the NBA playoffs, and I was struck by the ABC TV ads for their reality TV shows. They billed several as end-of-the-season events. Really? Since when is a weekly TV show an event? Another sign that reality TV shows are preempting actual reality. Next item. The guy who arranged for the photo of Air Force One flying over the Statue of Liberty resigned his position. He resigned his position for not thinking that citizens of New York City might be just a little bit scared by a 747 chased by two fighter planes buzzing the Statue of Liberty. Of course, that resignation reminds us to question where was NORAD on 9/11? Why didn't NORAD chase the four big old airplanes making U-turns in our skies for hours? Why didn't anyone resign over that catastrophe? No resignations happened, even as President Bush was warned in the presidential daily briefing the month before that Osama bin Laden was preparing to attack us with planes. Next item. This is from the Internet. A report by the National Academy of Science found that if a storm as severe as the one that happened in 1859 occurred today, it could cause $1 to $2 trillion in damages the first year and take 4 to 10 years to recover. The 1859 storm shorted out telegraph wires, caused fires in North America and Europe, sent readings of Earth's magnetic field soaring, and produced northern lights so bright that people read newspapers by their light. Today, there's a lot more than telegraph lines at stake. Vulnerable electrical grids circle the globe. Satellites, now vital for all forms of communication, can be severely disrupted, along with a global positioning system. While the most extreme events seem unlikely this time, there will probably be smaller-scale disruptions to electrical service, airline flights, GPS signals, and television, radio, and cell phones. There's been quite some speculation that our weather patterns may be strongly affected by solar flares, sunspot activity, and other off-planet causes. This theory supports the contention that global warming and global cooling has little to do with man's activities. So do sunspots or other phenomena taking place on the sun directly affect life on Earth? The economist William Stanley Jevons suggests that there is a relationship between sunspots and crises in business cycles. He reasoned that sunspots affect Earth weather, which in turn influence crop yields and therefore the economy. Further, it's been speculated that there may be a resonant gravitational link between a photospheric tidal force from the planets, the dominant components by summing gravitational tidal force, 75% being Jupiter's, with an 11-year cycle. Research has shown surprising correlations between sunspot activity and human health and behavior. Mutations in the influenza virus and subsequent flu pandemics correlate to sunspot peaks. During no less than 17 of the last solar cycles, sunspot peaks precede increased flu activity, including the 1918-19 Spanish flu pandemic, which followed a sunspot peak in 1917. During at least five of these periods, the influenza A virus underwent antigenetic shifts that allowed the virus to bypass built-up immunity in the population. Research conducted by my Biometeorological Research Center in the Netherlands supports the proposition that solar activity causes lowered human immunity. 30 years of research using 740,000 male subjects shows that blood sedimentation rates and resulting albumin and gamma globulin rates changes with sunspot activity. Researchers have also discovered correlation between human longevity and the amount of sunspot activity during the mother's birth year. The average person lives 2 to 3 years longer if their mother was born during a sunspot minimum. The sun is presently at a markedly heightened level of sunspot activity and was last similarly active over 8,000 years ago. Sunspots were rarely observed during the second part of the 17th century, which coincides with a period of cooling known as the Little Ice Age. Next item. For those who believe that only mainstream scientists have the answers, we give you the following. Italy experienced a major earthquake on April 6th of this year in L'Aquila, a city northeast of Rome. Apparently, Gioacchino Giuliani, a little-known scientist, forecast the earthquake in the region based on significant spikes in radon gas. Vans loaded with loudspeakers drove around L'Aquila a month ago before, telling locals to evacuate. Giuliani was reported to the police for spreading alarm and forced to take his findings off the internet. Now there are people who have to apologize to me and who will have what happened on their conscience, Giuliani said. Guido Berlusconi, the head of Italy's civil protection, insisted, "There is no possibility of predicting an earthquake. That is the view of the international scientific community." Next item. Just a random thought. Regarding the lack of any punishment for any of the many transgressions by government officials and agents for the multitude of sins committed, we as a nation are not yet evolved to the level of punishment. But we have at least reached the level of public exposure and perhaps embarrassment and possibly even shame. If not for the perpetrators, at least for their families. The actual perpetrators of the housing, banking, and Wall Street swindles, the torture memos, the Katrina screw-ups, the dismal failures around 9/11, these guys probably have no conscience nor regrets. But I wonder how their wives and children feel, having their fathers and husbands' names dragged through the mud and revealed as incompetents, if not outright crooks and scoundrels. One can only wonder when we as a nation will evolve to the level of actually holding those scoundrels accountable to the extent we punish them for their crimes. So far, we're at the wrist slap stage. I personally long for the good old days of tar and feathers. Next random thought. The elite who run our country have a brilliant method of maintaining fear amongst the sheeple. It's called the American private health care system. Its concept is as simple as it is brilliant. With a specter of catastrophic illness lurking in the background, no one but the extremely wealthy have enough money so that they can relax. Americans live in continual fear of health-related financial ruin. Why would the elite allow us to have the security of a fair and just natural health care system? Put simply, that would not serve their interests. Therefore, expect much smoke and mirrors, but no single-payer, not-for-profit health care reforms. I like to choose my battles carefully, and I think that the battle for single-payer health care is worth considering. Accordingly, I read a few articles. The first is by a fellow named Ralph Nader. You might remember him. He also seems to choose his battles carefully. This one's called The Single-Payer Taboo. It's by Ralph Nader. Among the giant taboos afflicting Congress these days is the proposal to create a single-payer health insurance system, often called full Medicare for everyone. How can this be? Don't the elected politicians represent the people? Don't they always have their finger to the wind? Well, single-payer is only supported by a majority of the American people, physicians and nurses. They like the idea of public funding and private delivery. They like free choice of doctors and hospitals that many are now denied by the HMOs. There are also great administrative efficiencies when single-payer displaces the health insurance industry and its claims-denying, benefit-restricting, bureaucratically heavy profiteering. According to leading researchers in this area, Dr. David Himmelstein and Dr. Stephanie Willander, single-payer will save $350 billion annually. Yet on Capitol Hill and at the White House, there are no meetings, briefings, hearings, and consultations about kinds of health care reforms that reform the basic price inflation, indifference to prevention, and discrimination by health insurers. There is no place at the table for single-payer advocates in the view of the congressional leaders who set the agenda and muzzle dissenters. Last month, at a breakfast meeting with reporters, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi responded to a question about health care with these revealing and exasperating words. Over and over again, we hear single payer, single payer, single payer. Well, it's not going to be a single payer. Thus spake Speaker Pelosi, the representative from Atina. Never mind that 75 members of her party have signed on to H.R. 676, the Conyers single-payer legislation. Never mind that in her San Francisco district, probably 3 out of 4 people want single-payer. And never mind that over 20,000 people die every year, according to the Institute of Medicine, because they cannot afford health insurance. What is more remarkable is that many more than the 75 members of the House privately believe single-payer is the best option. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Ted Kennedy, and Nancy Pelosi are among them. But they all say single-payer, quote, is not practical, so it's off the table. What gives here? The Democrats have the numbers and procedures to pass any kind of health reform this year, including single-payer. President Obama could sign it into law. But it's not practical. Because these politicians fear the insurance and pharmaceutical industries, and seek their campaign contributions more than they fear the American people. It comes down to the corporations who have no votes or are organized to the teeth and the people are not. So, when Senator Backus, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and a large recipient of health insurance and drug company donations, held a public roundtable discussion on 5 May, 15 witnesses were preparing to deliver their statements. Not one of them was championing single-payer. As Senator Baucus started his introductory remarks, something happened. One by one, 8 people in the audience, most of them physicians and lawyers, stood up to politely but insistently protest the absence of a single-payer presentation. One by one, the police came and took them out of the hearing room, arrested and handcuffed them. The charge was disruption of Congress, a misdemeanor. They call themselves the Backus Eight. immediately over the Internet and on C-SPAN, public radio, and the Associated Press. The news spread around the country. You can see the video on httpsinglepayeraction.org. To the many groups and individuals who have labored for single payer for decades, the Backus 8's protest seemed like an epiphany. Dr. Quentin Young, a veteran leader for single payer and founder of Physicians for a National Healthcare Program, emailed his reaction, quote, "For our part, when the history of this period is written, we believe your actions may well be noted as the turning point from a painful defensive position to a more appropriate offensive position vis-a-vis Senator Backus and his health industry co-conspirators." Close quote. Webster's Dictionary defines taboo as a prohibition against touching, saying, or doing something for fear of a mysterious superhuman force. For both Democrats and Republicans in Congress, it is of a fear of a very omnipresent supercorporate force. However, moral and evidential courage is coming. On May 12th of this year, Senator Backus is having another roundtable discussion with 13 more witnesses, including those from the business lobbies and their consultants. Word has it that the senator is about to invite a leading single-payer advocate to sit at the table. Here comes the people. Join this historic drive to have our country join the community of Western and some third-world nations by adopting a state-of-the-art single-payer system. Then Nader suggests that you visit singlepayeraction.org and break this taboo in your congressional district. So May 12th was yesterday. You have no news of what actually happened. Next article is by a pseudonym. He calls himself The Pen. It's from opednews.com. It's titled, "The Senate Laughs About How Many Police It Takes to Silence the American People." How many police does it take to silence the voice of the people? That's a question a despot might ask in a totalitarian police state. But this week, the Senate Finance Committee thought it was a hilarious joke as they ejected one brave activist after another for protesting that not even one spokesperson for single-payer health care was being allowed to sit at the hearing table. Yes, Senator Max Backus of Montana, who had preemptively declared that consideration of a single-payer option was off the table, actually joked, quote, "We need more police." And the rest of the Senate panel just laughed their heads off. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, the ranking Republican, not to be outdone in his contempt for the people, then asked if there was somewhere they can watch it on television, which elicited additional hearty guffaws. Yes, what a wonderful, entertaining show that would be the spectacle of the will of the people being excluded while corporate special interests, like butchers, carve up our pocketbooks and our bodies. The article then lists a web link for single-payer action, and that's www.peaceteam.net/action. It then adds, please note that the link above is the one to speak out for single-payer, not the many other balanced health care debate or affordable health care banners ads, which may also be on the same page, and which are nothing but a deceptive, industry-sponsored AstroTurf campaign. On the action page is an extended video where you can hear for yourself those senators laughing at us, and you be the judge, and you'll be just as outraged as we are. It's time for the U.S. Senate to get the message that we the people are not just a joke to be laughed off. Why is it that not one senator on that committee has the integrity to stand up for an even-handed debate of health care issues? Why should any of them be elected to public office ever again? So let's see a show of hands. How many of you would like to sign up now for a commie Marxist national health care system like Canada, England, and other pinko Bolshevik countries like that? How stupid do they think we are to try and reduce the terms of the debate to such an ignorant level? Meet the new mass media scare label, socialized medicine, as opposed to the anti-socialist corporate medical insurance industry we have now, where patients have no role except to be cash cows, by design never to be actually cured. If you or anyone in your family has ever been seriously ill, and as we all will someday, you know the medical industry will pick your bone clean of every dime you ever earned in your life, just in time to drop you into the cheapest possible pine box. Why are members of Congress fighting so hard to keep single-payer health care out of the public debate? Because there are no fat profits in it for their special interest corporate campaign contributors who maximize their profits the sicker we are. They cannot compete with a low-overhead, efficiently run government program, just like we have now with the existing proven medical care system. Instead, they'll line up a bunch of corporate lobbyists and stooges to tell bald-faced lies, just like Senator Jim Bunning himself, who asserted that Canada and England had a tax rate of at least 60% to support single-payer. But they don't even want anyone around to even have a chance to call them out on their willful and malicious lies. Yes, all of those who love to preach to the rest of us about the free market and competition are shown to be only interested in a rigged market and rigged debate. Bacchus may put on a face of being slightly chastised, but he still will not allow any honest testimony on single payer. But we can beat them. This is the pivotal moment. We've been speaking out for H.R. 676, Medicare for All, for years. And now, eight incredibly brave activists have been hauled away because they would not remain silent. But in doing so, in putting their own bodies on the line, they've shown up the current debate for the total sham that it is. We're not asking you to put your body on the line. All we're asking you to do is submit a one-click action page that we have specially configured to send your message to the Senate Finance Committee as a hard copy PDF that they can't just laugh off, because it will be part of the permanent record. Plus, your message will go to all of your regular members of Congress, plus your nearest daily newspaper, as well, if that option is selected. 3 minutes, 20 seconds into the video posted on the action page, you will hear a woman loudly ask, "I wonder how many there are." Let's show them. Let's show them there are millions and millions of us out here who will no longer be ignored and who will no longer be laughed off, because they know we can stop them if and only if large numbers of us will raise our voices now. Let's do it. And here's a list of all senators in the Finance Committee, including at least a couple who you might have considered to be liberals. Where are their voices? Is there not a single one of them who will stand up and say, "Wait a minute, we need to hear what the single-payer advocates have to say"? So especially if one of these is one of your personal senators, they especially need to hear from you. None of those are on the list are from California, so I omit reading the list. If you want to know who they are, refer to my webpage on kvmr.org, or you can go to that website I spoke of earlier and we'll mention again. Okay, back to the article. No, we don't need more police, Mr. Bacchus. We need fewer senators with plugs in their ears like Max Bacchus, and he and the rest of them need to hear that. On Yes, you can also respond to this action through the new Twitter gateway. Just send the following Twitter reply and add any personal comment you like. And then there's an address. I don't know anything at all about Twitter. But anyhow, the address that's given is at CXS, the pound signed, P982. So if you guys know Twitter, maybe you'll know what that is. If you want a step-by-step explanation of how to set up that Twitter thing, here's the link for that. No, I'm not going to read that link because I don't understand Twitter. The article concludes, "Please take action now so we can win all victories that are supposed to be ours and forward this alert as widely as possible." And, of course, it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyhow, that if you're opposed to single-payer and all of this, then you all should get involved, contact your congresspeople. There was a caller who gave up. Okay, I'm done reading the article, so if you want to call again, we'll put you on air. But I try not to interrupt articles in the middle of reading them. Okay, back to my commentary. One might ask, okay, here's the call. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hi, John.
You're
thanks
live.
For covering.
Yep.
Thank you. Thanks for covering this. I wanted to give you an update on the hearings yesterday.
Terrific.
Five more people were arrested, two of them nurses, two of them doctors, and one a healthcare advocate.
Okay.
I just sent you a link to the article.
Great.
And just to let people know, if they want to get more information about single-payer health care, either H.R. 676, the national version, or the California version, SB 810, they can go to healthcareforall.org.
Healthcareforall.org.
Yes, healthcareforall.org. That will also show your Sacramento listeners where they can find the first Saturday of the month monthly meetings, and your Grass Valley area listeners, Nevada County area, third Thursday of the month at Escaton at 6:30 at Breck Center. And it lists a local contact as well.
Okay, so for local people, there's a meeting at Escaton? And how do they get more information on that?
They can call Cindy at 277-6149.
Okay.
And that's third Thursdays at 6:30 p.m. at the Rec Center at Escaton.
Okay. Thank you very much. Give us the website one final time.
It's healthcareforall.org.
Healthcareforall.org. Okay, thanks very much for your call and your information.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay, back to my commentary. One might ask, why is Obama not leading this battle for true healthcare reform? I think one indication of Obama's political methodology is his repeating a quote from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It seems that FDR was in a discussion with an advocate for some political position. The activist presented his arguments, and FDR famously replied, "Personally, I agree with everything you say, but politically, you'll have to make me do it." Perhaps it's time for we the people to make Obama, the Democratic leadership, and all of Congress do what we want them to do. If you feel strongly about this issue, perhaps you might want to contact your representatives, and just as importantly, contact friends in other states and ask them to get involved. After all, it's only your health and your wallet that's at stake. Okay, the time is 12:35. The radio station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamberlain. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing. This next article was sent to me by one of my favorite astrologers, Daniel Gemario. And it is from Rolling Stone magazine. The author is Matt Taibbi. The Big Takeover. The global economic crisis isn't about money, it's about power. How Wall Street insiders are using the bailout to stage a revolution. It's over. We're officially royally screwed. No empire can survive being rendered a permanent laughingstock, which is what happened as of a few weeks ago when the buffoons who've been running things in this country finally went one step too far. It happened when Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner was forced to admit that he was once again going to have to stuff billions of taxpayer dollars into a dying insurance giant called AIG, itself a profound symbol of our national decline. A corporation that got rich insuring the concrete and steel of American industry in the country's heyday, only to destroy itself, chasing phantom fortunes at the Wall Street card tables, like a dissolute nobleman gambling away the family estate in the waning days of the British Empire. The latest bailout came as AIG admitted to having just posted the largest quarterly loss in American corporate history, some $661.7 billion. In the final 3 months of last year, the company lost more than $27 million every hour. And all of this happened at the end of 8 straight years that America devoted to frenetically chasing the shadow of a terrorist threat to no avail. 8 years spent stopping every citizen at every airport to search every purse, bag, crotch, and briefcase for juice boxes and explosive tubes of toothpaste. Yet in the end, our government had no mechanism for searching the balance sheets of companies that held life or death power over our society and was unable to spot holes in the national economy the size of Libya, whose entire gross domestic product last year was smaller than AIG's 2008 losses. So it's time to admit it. We're fools, protagonists in a kind of gruesome comedy about the marriage of greed and stupidity. And the worst part of it is that we're still in denial. We still think this is some kind of unfortunate accident, not something that was created by the group of psychopaths on Wall Street whom we allowed to gang-rape the American dream. When Geithner announced the new $30 billion bailout, the party line was that poor AIG was just a victim of a lot of bad luck. Bad year for business, you know, what with the financial crisis and all. Edward Liddy, the company's CEO, actually compared it to catching a cold. Quote, "The marketplace is a pretty crummy place to be right now," he said. When the world catches pneumonia, we get it too. In a pathetic attempt at name-dropping, he even whined that AIG was being consumed by the same issues that are driving house prices down and 401k statements down and Warren Buffett's investment portfolio down. Liddy made AIG sound like an orphan begging in a soup line, hungry and sick from being left out in somebody else's financial weather. He conveniently forgot to mention that AIG had spent more than a decade systematically scheming to evade U.S. and international regulators, or that one of the causes of its, quote, pneumonia was making colossal, world-sinking $500 billion bets with money it didn't have in a toxic and completely unregulated derivative market. Nor did anyone mention that when AIG finally got up from its seat at the Wall Street casino, broke and busted, in the after-dawn light, it owed money all over town, and that a huge chunk of your taxpayer dollars in this particular bailout scam will be going to pay off the other high rollers at its table, or that this was a casino unique among all casinos, one where middle-class taxpayers cover the bets of billionaires. People are pissed off about this financial crisis and about the bailout, but they're not pissed off enough. The reality is that the worldwide economic meltdown and the bailout that followed were together a kind of revolution, a coup d'etat. They cemented and formalized a political trend that has been snowballing for decades, the gradual takeover of the government by a small class of connected insiders who used money to control elections, buy influence, and systematically weaken financial regulations. The crises were the coup de grace. Given virtually free rein over the economy, these same insiders first wrecked the financial world, then cunningly granted themselves nearly unlimited emergency powers to clean up their own mess. And so the gambling addict leaders of companies like AIG end up not penniless and in jail, but with an alien-style death grip over the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. Our partners in the government, as Liddy put it with a shockingly casual matter-of-factness after the most recent bailout. The mistake most people make in looking at the financial crises is thinking of it in terms of money, a habit that might lead you to look at the unfolding mess as a huge bonus-killing downer for the Wall Street class. But if you look at it in purely Machiavellian terms, what you see is a colossal power grab that threatens to turn the federal government into a kind of giant Enron, a huge impenetrable black box filled with self-dealing insiders whose scheme is the securing of individual profits at the expense of an ocean of unwittingly involved shareholders, previously known as taxpayers. For Matt Tabby's complete report, including the people behind the crash, and a look at those who stand to profit from it, check out issue 1075 of Rolling Stone magazine. So the bottom line is, his point is that this whole economic crisis and the bailouts is a takeover of the U.S. government by the Wall Street banksters. And you might want to look at it in that light. Next article, unless something preempts it. Oh, okay. All right, this is Fox News. You want me to read something from Fox News?
It looks interesting.
All right. Our alternative rabble-rouser, John Fletcher, just handed me something. We'll read it. World Health Organization is investigating claims made by an Australian researcher that the new swine flu virus may have evolved as a result of human error. Adrian Gibbs said that he planned to publish a report saying the never-before-seen strain of influenza may have evolved in eggs used to grow viruses for scientific research and vaccine development. This is according to Bloomberg News. The noted virologist said his findings could help better understand the microbe's ability to spread. World Health Organization Assistant Director General of Health Security, Keiji Fukuda, is reviewing the study, Bloomberg reported. If Gibbs' research is confirmed, Fukuda said it will raise many new questions about the new strain. Quote, was the development part of a vaccine virus? Was this developed as some sort of research project? And in those instances, was it released on purpose? Was it an accidental release? What would be the circumstances? He was quoted as saying this. However, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta analyzed the report and concluded there is no evidence to support Gibbs' conclusion. There you have it. Okay, next article. Wanda Sykes takes aim and pierces Limbaugh's treasonous heart. It's by Robert Arend in opednews.com. This is Wanda Sykes, quoted at the White House Correspondents' Dinner of this month. Quote, Rush Limbaugh said he hopes this administration fails. So you're saying, I hope America fails. You're like, I don't care about people losing their homes, their jobs, our soldiers in Iraq. He just wants the country to fail. To me, that's treason. MSNBC and CNN did cover Sykes-Limbaugh remarks in depth immediately after the dinner and early the next day. Then they shied away from them into the afternoon and evening, in favor of her less controversial cracks about media coverage of the president's nipples and Nancy Pelosi's conspiracy to assassinate by hamburger. But Sykes may yet succeed where others have failed, in forever marking the shameless Rush Limbaugh for the traitor to country he truly is, in ending his disgraceful career. I recall a similar tipping point involving a United States senator from Wisconsin and the chief counsel for the United States Army. Joseph Welch. Quote, until this moment, Senator, I think I never gauged your cruelty or your recklessness. Attorney Joseph Welch rebuking Joe McCarthy. Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency? Few in the mainstream news media realized that day, June 9, 1954, how mortal the wound to McCarthy was. But Welch had slayed the terrible demagogue at once and forever. Exactly 3 months before McCarthy's final shame under the tongue-lashing of Joseph Welch, Edward R. Murrow began to open the eyes of the public with the half-hour television special, a report on Senator Joe McCarthy, which exposed McCarthy's contradictions and demagoguery. By the time Welch completely outed McCarthy's putrid soul, the senator's millions of admirers and supporters were fully ready to shun him. Rush Limbaugh says he hopes this administration fails. So you're saying, I hope America fails. You're like, I don't care about people losing their homes, their jobs, our soldiers in Iraq. He just wants the country to fail. To me, that's treason, Wanda said. To me, that's treason crosses back through time to have you left no sense of decency. Are the quotes about to merge to take down the 21st century McCarthy, Rush Limbaugh? If history's a gauge, this early 21st century repeat of 1950 demagoguery has passed zenith and is rapidly collapsing to an end. In the beginning was McCarthy. McCarthy begat Rush Limbaugh, who begat Karl Rove, who begat George W. Bush. Also in the beginning was Edward R. Murrow, who begat Keith Olbermann, who begat Rachel Maddow. Yet, if history is truly repeating, Joseph Welch begat Wanda Sykes. Using all of McCarthy's skills of targeting and branding foes of Bush-Cheney policies as unpatriotic and America-haters, the new communists, Karl Rove and Dick Cheney channeled McCarthy to a level even McCarthy would never have envisioned. A brew of Joseph Goebbels' McCarthyism, so toxic that it very nearly suffocated to death the whole of the American Republic. False patriotism in 9/11, wrapped up in stars and stripes shell, was dropped in a kettle of boiling fear of terror and the blood of our soldiers' sons and daughters. Bush Cheney were evil gods who could see and hear everything. Step out of line, the man comes and takes you away. Now we have a quote from Keith Olbermann. I've got a caller, but you're going to have to wait until the end of this article. We have a quote from Keith Olbermann. I was stuck on the tarmac at LAX with nothing to do but read the Associated Press stories on my ESPN-issued mobile phone. And there it was, Don Rumsfeld calling me morally or intellectually confused, or the equivalent of a Nazi appeaser, or both. Not just me, mind you, but all of us who dared question Iraq, or the game of Simon Says that is the juvenile and ineffective new domestic counterterrorism rules, or the Bush administration itself. And I searched the rest of that part of the web offered me by the phone for the righteous indignation, for the atomic bomb of verbiage from the poets of the left, for the repudiation of this historically backward twisting of all that had happened since about 1933. Nothing. It was a moment I gather that some non-swimmers experience when a child falls into the deep water and nobody else makes a move. As time slowed, they inevitably recall they wanted to see who else was going to dive in. Upon realizing nobody was, the thought formed not of heroism or of urgency, but of resignation. This does not always turn out well. Some drown, some don't. Some prevail and everyone lives. But in the moment, you understand that if you're going to go down, at least you're going to go down for something worthwhile. I started scribbling the first comment by hand on the back of my trip itinerary. This was Keith Olbermann writing in his book, Truth and Consequences, describing when he finally decided to get on board. 25 years beyond Orwell's 1984 and nearly 2 years and 5 months into the life of his MSNBC countdown broadcast, history repeated the Murrow against False Patriotism error with Keith Olbermann, a man steeped professionally in sports, privately in the love of history and of the simple values of his country. His special comments punctured the facade of the false patriots, the rule by fearmongers, the traitors pointing fingers at us. Olbermann's nightly rants against the liars and the warmongers drove up his viewership and likely were critical to the eventual resistance to and near universal repudiation of the most criminally corrupt presidency in American history. Olbermann grooved Rachel Maddow for the time slot after him, and perhaps to guarantee truth will survive, should he not. Yet justice still evades. In spite of a warehouse of evidence of Bush administration lawbreaking, from illegal spying, lying to Congress and to the American people to make war, from renditions to torture and other war crimes that likely include murder, no prosecutions, no prison sentences, only dual-party political posturing and sham congressional hearings. In the 21st century, McCarthy still reigns, puking his poisonous bile into the public airwaves, dangerous not because millions of people listen to him, but because too many politicians fear his audience may be swayed not to vote for them. Limbaugh, the face in the crowd, who cares only for his enormous wealth, maintained by the powerful instrument of talk radio, as with all his historical demagogues, when the walls of change close in on them, has now so inflated his demands on the Republicans, manufactured false causes to attack everything Barack Obama, and stripped naked, from indifference to outright contempt, his views of all who are suffering under the weight of the greed-driven recession, many of which are or were his own audience. Driven to utter madness under the weight of preserving his own wealth and influence, Limbaugh has finally reached the point of McCarthy, overreach, awaiting the new Joseph Welch with a sharp enough pin to burst his media bubble. In spite of the media's attempts to sweep Wanda Sykes' blistering comments about Rush Limbaugh off of their news desks, the day after tomorrow is another day. Olbermann and Maddow will surely give Wanda's branding of Limbaugh as a traitor to his country new life. I can hear the whistle of air leaking ever more rapidly from out of the ditto-head universe. For in fact, all of history's demagogues were traitors, loyal only to themselves. Rush Limbaugh is a traitor to both his audience and his country. Very soon, his audience will desert him just as surely as they did McCarthy. Wanda knows. She knows that we know the truth, too. That was Robert Arend writing in opednews.com. We have a call. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hi there, Chamba. This is Margaret Mary calling in, appreciating your news today, your show.
Okay.
And I'm sitting here with Lorraine Webb at Ike's and wanting to thank you for last week's interview, and it occurred to me to remind you and your viewers that we're doing another workshop this weekend, this Saturday, at Nevada City Veterans.
You're on the radio.
I'm so confused.
Okay. So briefly, just give the information on the website, on the workshop.
Great. It's preparing for the Emerging New World 2012, talking about the crop circles and all the different changes, the accelerated frequencies and the shifts that we're all experiencing in one way or another,
okay,
and how to best prepare and the tools for that.
Okay. And the time and the place.
Sure. That is, it is Saturday, May 16th from 10 to 4.
Right.
And Lee Hanks' phone number is 321-297-3100. And the website for more information is newworldintegration.com.
Fine. Okay.
Thanks, Chamba.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Have
Bye-bye.
A good day.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, the writer of the following article is a Pakistani from the Pashtun tribe. He's studying in Germany. He's not a trained journalist, and he writes in Pakistani English, which may be a bit hard to follow, but I think his perspective is worth our attention. He titles it Bombs for Pashtuns and Dollars for Punjab. It's published in opednews.com. Pashtuns, definition of Pashtuns, it's the ethnic group living on both sides of the Durand line, which divides Afghanistan and Pakistan, and most affected. And it's the most affected ethnicity in the pre- and post-9/11 Afghan war. Punjab is the eastern province of Pakistan. It received the least damage in the war on terror, and most of the Pakistani civil and military offices are in the Punjab. I would like to mention here a base for choosing the title for this article. In Pashtun culture, Hejra, guest house, is very old and big social institution, and it is different from guest houses of modern world. It is a common guest house of many neighboring families, and most of the men sit and discuss the current issues of the evening in an informal way. The elders tell their expertise, and the youngers listen and analyze their expertise, keeping in mind the current situation. Now this hejra took a modern shape, and Pashtuns have a web hejra, where many educated Pashtuns from all over the world come and discuss different topics. As Pashtuns are the people affected badly in war on terror, therefore, most of the discussion in this electronic hejra is about the worries and difficulties of Pashtuns today. Pashtuns are also very much conscious about the future and the exploitation of their blood, emotions, resources, and their motherland. In such a situation, one of the members of this electronic hejra used this title for a thread in hejra Bombs for Pashtuns and Dollars for Punjab. This attracted me, and with his permission, I used this title for my article. Why Pashtuns think so? There are many reasons for this, and most of these are based on facts, but due to the brutalities of Taliban terrorists and Pakistan Army, it is difficult for a common Pashtun to open lips on this subject. It is evident that Pashtuns as a nation did not harm anyone, and at least in the last two centuries did not invade any neighboring country, and they did not interfere in the affairs of anyone. They are attacked, killed, destroyed, handicapped, displaced, terrorized, insulted, divided, and their resources exploited by many, including Britain, Russia, America, Iran, Mughals, they ruled the Indian subcontinent until 1857, Arabs and Pakistanis, who are mainly Punjabis. It is our mistake to live in this area, strategically important, and is lying in the south of the USSR, north of Iran, and east of Pakistan. It was our mistake that most of the Indian occupied Britain's rule, but we fought for our freedom and independence. It is our mistake that we did not accept Mughal rule. We did not accept Iranian nor Russian brutalities. In the current situation, our mistake is that the Arab terrorists were deployed by the USA and Pakistan, without our permission, on our land. Pashtuns were not strong enough to stop the superpower of the day from the satanic act, which was called Holy War that time by the USA, Middle East, and Pakistan. Pashtuns were not strong enough then to get rid of this violent and brutal Arabs and Pakistanis. Pashtuns were not strong enough to stop Iran and Russia from interfering and creating anarchy in their country. Pashtuns are the real victims of the whole game. Pashtuns have a population of about 43 million living on both sides of the Durand line, the imaginary line between Pakistan and Afghanistan dividing Pashtuns. It is hard to find any family not affected by war prevailing through the last three decades. They are today known as terrorists, but they are terrorized more than anyone else by both parties of war on terror. Killing of innocent citizens each day in Afghanistan as collateral damage is the best example. The use of citizens as a human shield by Taliban and Al-Qaeda terrorists is another example. The displacements of millions of Afghans during the late 70s and early 80s, and then again during the Taliban regime. Taliban are in no way representative of Pashtuns, as they were created by Pakistan with support of the USA, and their difficulties are the examples of terrorizing Pashtuns. Now internal displacement of about 1.2 million Pashtuns in Pakistan is another terrible story. The respectable people with beautiful, sober, and polite faces are now compelled to stand in the queue for a piece of bread. I would like to invite the attention of the international community regarding this issue. There are many individuals, organizations, and governments in the world supporting strong army action in Pashtun-dominated areas where most of the terrorists are hiding. We, as a Pashtun nation, are no way against destroying hideouts of terrorists. But we want to ask one question. Will these people support bringing the players into criminal court that trained, supported, and created these terrorists? These trainers, supporters, and creators are presently in the USA, Pakistan, and the Middle East. They can argue that three decades before it was matching USA, Pakistan, and Middle East interest. My question is again, then why Pashtuns should be paying the price for their interests? Will international community ask USA and other powers to force Pakistani government to provide the grant directly to the affected people of the region? A week before, the provincial information minister of the Northwest Frontier Province, Pakistan, said openly in a press conference that provincial government did not receive a penny for the war on terror. Where does the money go that goes to Pakistan for the war on terror? That is why this type of discussion is evident in Pashtun. Bombs for Pashtuns and dollars for Punjab. The displaced people need some temporary camps where they can spend their time with respect, not as beggars. But all this needs money, and provincial government is unable to provide the required facilities with its limited resources and authority. U.S. officials say continuously that they will provide blank checks to Pakistan, and Pakistani officials say that they will not receive blank checks, but in fact, both are doing the same. If these internally displaced people are not helped properly, most of them will join the terrorists and will strengthen them. It is very much wished from the international communities to take a real interest